Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, right here in the studios of Tantalk Radio Network. It is such a wonderful day, and I am thrilled that I have back on the program somebody actually by popular demand, because I was impressed with the number of emails I got about this guest I had just a few weeks ago, and wow, you know, he's not one of these global best-selling authors, so it was exciting that something about him sparked an interest in my listeners. Ed Hedgem I'm just so happy to welcome you back to the program, Ed, to talk about your book, On the Road Less Traveled, An Unlikely Journey from the Orphanage to the Boardroom. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Patsy with a Z. Thanks. It's good to be back. I'm glad you got some emails. It was a worthwhile experience for you.
Well, it was. It just turned out so well. You know, we didn't have a lot of time last time. Just the beginning of your story is so fascinating, that you were kidnapped by your father. You were told that your mother was dead, and you lived for years thinking that she was dead, only to discover that perhaps your father wasn't telling you the truth along the way. So that part of your story, that part of your life was so fascinating. And we only had a short time to talk about this travel to the boardroom, but my listeners, and apparently quite a few of them, remember Lehman Brothers, and it struck a chord with them. Now, I was, of course, that was before my time, but in 2008, I definitely felt the repercussions of a major stock market crash. But so many of my listeners wanted to know more about those years, how you started companies, your philosophy on how you started companies, some of the companies that you started, how you got to that boardroom. Because, I mean, you come from, you know, very, you know, simple background, and you just got way up there, and I don't know how many boards you were on. Of course, your book started with the story of you winning or being awarded the Horatio Alger Award, and that's how the book started, and actually it ends that way, too, you explaining why this award is so meaningful. But tell us about those years in between. How in the world did you do it?
Well, to me, you are a victim of your circumstance, of your context. And when I was at business school, I was a chemical engineer thinking of going back into the chemical industry. You know, just like when Dustin Hoffman was told to go into plastics, I had a background in plastics engineering. But at the business school, I discovered that I had a real interest in finance. And I really was more interested in companies in general and the way companies work, how they function. I also had I had a passion for putting people together to solve problems, or putting people together to produce a product, or putting people together to, you know, do a project. And that flashes me back to my college days when I started a humor magazine in my junior year. Everybody was against it, the president, the provost, the head librarian. So I put 30 people together, and I said, I want to create something just like the Harvard Lampoon, and we did. And I learned that what I really got a kick out of was watching people and helping people do better than they thought they could. This matured in the graduate school into an interest in basically management and then in finance. And so I went into finance and was very lucky to get a good job with a company in California in an industry which was just beginning. It sounds crazy, but in 1964, the mutual fund industry was a very, very small industry. I went to work for the second largest company. They only had about $300 million in assets under management. Today, they have a couple of trillion. So I went there, and I learned another aspect of how to be successful, which is one, to try to find trends or cycles or waves, or what I call latent demand or unsatisfied needs, and try to get involved in that early on. As in the mutual fund business, when I went into it, it was a very small business, and obviously it grew to be a very large business And if you stayed in that business, you did very well. And I did for 10 years. I stayed in the mutual fund business for 10 years. Then I went to Wall Street, which again was a relatively small business back in those days. Companies were, you know, hundreds of people instead of thousands of people. And I got on that wave. And then, of course, I hit the big wave of all times in the 80s and 90s. The stock market went up 10 times. So I say to people, first of all, and try to work with people that you enjoy. Find people that can help you. And I say, basically, you're only as good as the people you surround yourself with. So I have these little, these important kinds of decisions. You know, I really enjoy helping people do better than they think they can. I try to surround myself with the best people that can do things I can't do. I also try to not take credit. You know, give credit away. And Ronald Reagan said this, you could do almost anything if you don't worry about who gets credit. So these kinds of things. And then if you can catch a wave, you're very lucky. In 1983, I took over as the chairman of, and CEO of a small investment bank. And we had 70 people and about $20 million of revenues. And over 14 years, we grew it to 800 people and about a half a billion in revenues. And that sounds like I did a good job. Well, I did. But simultaneously, the stock market was up 10 times. So I was riding a very good wave. And there are many waves today in today's market. Young people almost have too many things they can get involved with. You know, artificial intelligence, genomics, nanoscience, neuroscience, you know, the whole area of healthcare, health tech, fintech, you know, ed tech, all these things are going to change. You know, we're digitizing the world so that young people today have huge advantages, and there are many waves out there they can catch. So find a series of things that, you know, excite you. Find your passion, as I did, to manage people, which was my passion. Find some tenets that you could use to make yourself successful. And mine was basically letting people know that I was really interested in, that I really wanted them to do well. And then, of course, you can give away as much credit as you can. You know, make sure people recognize that you appreciate what they do. And then, if you're lucky, you catch a wave or two or cycle. That's a long answer to a very good question.
Well, you know, when we look back at your life, it is so exciting. And when you got to Wall Street, you know, as some of my listeners wrote to me, well, they're saying, he was Lehman Brothers. And I said, not exactly. I said, you know, and people want to know what happened with that. And of course, none of this sort of the stain of so much of the things that went on went to you, because you were always trying to do right, trying to do a great job for your clients and for people and for all of your employees. So I think there's still some people out there who wonder what happened with Lehman Brothers. And since you have some inside knowledge, just tell them a little bit about that.
Oh yeah, well, it was one of the things in life. People ask me, "What's the worst thing that ever happened to you?" And you think I would give you an example of, you know, something in my childhood. The worst thing that can happen to most anybody is when you do absolutely the right thing for a relatively long period of time. In my case, it was seven years at Lehman Brothers, and I had a young family, and you know, they were very important to me, so I had other obligations, but. You know, I was working very, very hard to do the right thing. And at Lehman Brothers for 7 years, I basically turned around the securities division, which is the brokerage division. And the boss, Mr. Glucksman, Lou Glucksman, pushed me out into money management, hoping, I guess, that I would fail. And there again, I succeeded beyond even my wildest imaginations. And we grew that from $2 billion to $10 billion in under 3 years. And then he came after me and wanted me to support him to push out Mr. Peterson. He wanted the company to himself, and I said I wouldn't do that. And so he pushed me out of that job. So I spent 7 years working very hard, trying to do the right thing and actually doing the right thing, and yet still it didn't work out. And I think people have to recognize that's one of the things that if you can overcome that, then you can overcome almost anything. When you do all the right things and things still go wrong, and that's the way life is. That happens. Anyway, at Lehman Brothers, it was a problem of basically a man who was power hungry, unfortunately. And he really wanted to rule the company, and he had some of the talents that were very important to the company. He knew his business very well, but he didn't know a lot of the other businesses very well. but he wanted to run the whole company. And he kept pushing to do that. And Pete Peterson was the CEO and the chairman, and he finally gave up his, he was co-CEO with his fellow, Lou Glucksman. And finally, Lou just pushed him out. And Pete decided to leave and left the company to Glucksman. And then a bunch of other rest of us left. There was actually a big article in the New York Times with a big cartoon. It showed a big ship with the name Lehman on it, and everybody jumping off it, including me. And 7 months later, Lou Glucksman unfortunately did what he had done back in 1974. He got the company in trouble, and they sold out to Shearson. That was the first sort of mentality, that the first time that Lehman went under. They basically sold the company to Shearson in what was considered to be a fire sale. Then the second iteration of Lehman is when they came back out public again, and one of the partners who was there with Lou took over the company, and the rest of that is history. And unfortunately, they had some real problems in the 2008. They went belly up and bankrupt, and you know, hurt a lot of people. So those were the two iterations of Lehman. I was in the first one, the one that lasted 135 years, and still at that point in time, because of Glucksman's lack of knowledge of all of the businesses and his desire for power and his pushing out a lot of good people, the company, you know, was hurt in 1984 and was sold out to Shearson, and they became Shearson Lehman. But it was a difficult place, but they had so many smart people. I mean, think of what came out of Lehman. You know, Pete Peterson and a young partner took over and started something called Blackstone, which is one of the most successful private equity firms in the business. Steve Schwarzman is now running that, and he and Peterson left and formed that company. And if you look through Wall Street, a lot of us, including myself, I became the chairman of a small investment bank and did well with that. And there were people that went to Dillon Reed, they went to Morgan Stanley. I mean, Lehman basically staffed a great number of firms on Wall Street because we had so many smart people, and they were doing such a good job. Back in 1983, the year that I left, we had record profits. So it was kind of a very sad story about a man, basically, that just, he wanted power, and power was more important than anything else. And in your life, if you come across someone like that, it's better to leave earlier rather than spend 7 years, as I did, trying to fix it.
Well, you know, the important thing is that as people read this book, they will really get into that era, that period of time, and all of the permutations of what was going on in these companies. And, you know, out of it, you were always, we can see just from the articles that were written about you, that you wanted to do something good. You know, you realized the power of money to do good for people, not just for, you know, your employees and for your company, but also then what you could do with that money. And I liked how you compared the difference between Lehman and Furman Sells. Explain that.
Well, that's so important. It's a great insight by you. At a certain point in your life, and obviously starting with nothing, money was very important to me. But when I left Lehman, you know, I had a chance to go to a very prestigious other prestigious firm. But I went to a small firm where I could really make a difference. And I was trading my big office at Lehman Brothers, overlooking, you know, the Statue of Liberty, for my office at Furman Sells, which looked at a brick wall, and trading in the fancy dining room at Lehman Brothers, which was one of the best on Wall Street, for our conference room, which had two hot plates in it. And so, you know, it was wonderful because I really had, and I always say this, you know, I used to have a buzzer on my desk at Lehman Brothers and I could ring it and have somebody come in and bring me, you know, a cup of coffee or an iced tea. At Furman Sells, there was no such buzzer. I just got up and got my own iced tea. I got my own coffee. But, you know, what happened at that point in my life is I had made enough money, what I call just enough. I wasn't rich, but I was just enough. And I really sought freedom, something that I could do myself where I could control my own fate. And I went to a firm where I could really help a lot of people. And, you know, and essentially be the boss as well. I liked running things. And I was 47 years old, so I'd had 20 years experience on Wall Street, which I recommend to people before they really assume a senior management role, that they take some time to, you know, learn some things. And I learned things at Lehman Brothers. It was a very good firm in many aspects. It just was run by people, that one man who wanted too much power. But money still is important. Unfortunately, to do good in the world today, and as I did at the University of Rochester, you know, having money and be able to help young people, especially in the scholarship area, is really a great joy. But in order to get there, you have to earn the money. And I think other people who have given money recognize that. But there's a certain point in your life when you basically have enough and you can really concentrate on helping people. You know, as I think Scott Peck said in the book called The Road Less Traveled, unlike On the Road Less Traveled, he said, love is giving to others. And I really believe that.
Well, of course, you have a big, strong supporter in a wife who has kept you grounded, I think.
Absolutely. Now, you know, without Barbara, I wouldn't be here. I kid about that, but I do love her less, more than yesterday and less than tomorrow. She's been there every step of the way, and that's another thing that I tell people. Find partners. And the most important partner is what I call P1. The partner that you can find someone to love, find someone you can share your life with, find someone who you can support and who will support you and who gets to know you. You know, it's very important that we've been married for 55 years, and she knows all of my weaknesses and my strengths, and she basically keeps track of me and makes me, you know, do the things I should do. And when I step out of line, she's willing to tell me, and I do the same with her. So finding partners, I always say, find partners that do things that you can't do. Find partners that do things that you don't want to do. And if you find those kinds of partners, you end up doing things that you want to do that you do well. So, as I said, I'll repeat this. I was only as good as the people I surrounded myself with, and the most important person I've had to surround myself with is my wife, Barbara. She basically took on some responsibilities which I didn't do well. I mean, the house, the family, all that stuff, that was hers. And she did an outstanding job of it. And I went to work and really didn't have to worry about it. And I still don't worry about it. I mean, she still pays all the bills.
Even though you're the financial whiz of Wall Street, the funny thing is, you know, when you have somebody like that who grounds you, somebody that is proud of you, and it keeps you sort of on the straight and narrow, which is important. Yeah. When you're dealing with so much money and such wild financial times and just events that happen on Wall Street, to be grounded and to sort of stay on the straight and narrow and know where you're going and know that you want to do something with your money. And you certainly have. You know, they write about you, of course, that you're a philanthropist and that you do a lot of things to help people. And in the end, you know, making money is fun. It's a game. But if you don't have a purpose, if you don't have something that you want to do, it really doesn't mean anything in the end.
Well, Patsy, with a Z, you're absolutely right. That is the most important statement is that, you know, when I was doing this, an older gentleman came up to me and he said, you know, you're doing the right thing. You're giving with warm hands. And with that, I can reinforce that basically with the fact that, you know, you never really give anything away. You always get more than you give. I mean, I'll give you an example. There's a young lady who I gave a scholarship to. She was 5 foot high. She was a concert violinist and pianist, and she was an optics engineering major. And she got up when she was getting her PhD and said, you know, if it wasn't for Mr. Hagem, I wouldn't be here. That paid for anything I've ever done, you know. And there are many, many kids like that that I've spent time with and tried to help out. Because scholarship changed my life, and therefore I feel giving scholarships changed people's lives. Because education is the solution to almost everything, or is a solution to everything. And if you give a kid a chance, a young person a chance to get a good education, then the rest is up to that person. But, you know, I find that giving is so important. And if you have a lot of money, you give a lot of money. If you don't have a lot of money, you give what you can. You give up your time.
Exactly. I mean, I know people who don't have a lot of money, but they're so generous with their time and giving just joy to people. And that's, you know, that's in the end, that's the important thing in life. And one of the funny comments I got about our last interview, someone wrote to me, Well, he said he's been married 55 years, but he doesn't sound it. He sounds young. And I said,
well, you know, when you ask a four-year-old how old he is, he says, I'm 4 3/4. Well, I'm 84 3/4.
Well, yeah, well, you're still on top of your game. You're still up there, and that I think also that was an inspiration for my listeners when some of them realized that, well, you weren't, because you sound young, and you sound vigorous, and you sound, you know, so enthusiastic, and so they're thinking you're in your 50s, and so you surprise them when you said 55 years, and they're trying to calculate, well, why he was doing this, you know, when he was born. So it's nice that somebody at your age is still out there doing it, trying to do the best that he can and help the world and help people and just be a wonderful husband and father. And that's certainly, Ed Hajim, that's what you are. And this book, this book, On the Road Less Traveled, An Unlikely Journey from the Orphanage to the Boardroom, is fascinating. Part of it reads sort of like a mystery story because you don't know what's going to happen. I didn't know all the sort of permutations of what's going to happen in your life. And so I think it's a wonderful book. It's available wherever books are sold, and people can just get the book. I think it's inspirational, and it makes people hopeful that, first of all, everyone wants to live to be your age and still be as sharp as a tack. You know, that's wonderful.
Well, any my book is take away whether anything is possible. But, you know, the most important, one of my reviewers said, it reads like fiction, but it's real life. But even now, the book has changed my life because it's opened up a whole new area because I'm becoming involved in foster kids that are going to college now. There's a group in Boston called Wiley, which I've become involved with, which I'd never heard of. And they basically help kids from foster homes in college. And so I've got a whole new track to work on right now because there are 72 of them. They're all in Boston. And there's a bunch of them strung across the country where, you know, I can help them because I can really, you know, I've been there, done that. I arrived at college, you know, with the wrong clothes and the wrong attitude and the wrong suitcase full of stuff. So, you know, I can help those kids. And that's my new thrust, to work with the foster kids that are in college.
Well, it has been a thrill, just a thrill to talk to you. You certainly deserve this Horatio Alger Award. You are an inspiration. The American dream is alive and well, and people can, you can do anything out there. And all you have to do is get this book, On the Road Less Traveled, by Ed Hajim, and just get inspired. Ed, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you again for inviting me back. You made my day.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye now.
Okay. Wonderful. Isn't he fantastic? I love him. He's, my goodness. People, what are you going to be doing when you're 85 years old? Are you going to be like that? Sharp? I hope so. Okay, we're going to go to commercial, and then we'll be... Oh, no, I'm sorry. I have the Book Buzz, a special one from Devon Miller for May, our first airing of this Book Buzz, okay?
Hey, everyone, it's Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety Talk Club children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. Already becoming a national bestseller and ranking in at number one in not just one or two, but three categories on Amazon is the book Come In, Come In, written by best-selling children's book author Roger Hutcherson. Roger's book became number one in the following categories: number one in children's multiculturalism and tolerance, number one in children's social skills, and number one in children's fiction on social situations, all on Amazon. After an experience at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut where shootings occurred, Roger had the honor of painting with kids who saw for their own eyes of the devastating incident. That experience affected him and convinced him to serve those who grieve with his writing and art. In Roger's latest written work, readers get to visit a child's dream of a world where everyone is welcome. Come In, Come In takes readers to a world that's not like any other. It's a world illustrated by Nikki Mills, filled with elephant clouds, dancing tricycles, giggling moons, and so much more. It's a world presenting a possibility in which everyone accepts each other for exactly as they are. It's a world inviting the reader to come and explore. It's a world where you'll certainly see me visiting again and again when reading. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back with my next guest. I hope I pronounce her name right. I mess up people's names all over the place. I'm going to say Kara Ruda.
You did it.
I got it, Kara. Okay. Kara Ruda. Whoa. I'm not going to say that. Some of your book is a little bit rude, but I'm Kara Ruda. I think, you know, it is very funny, Kara. The day I got your book, I was in a mood. I was in a reading mood, and I was reading Stendhal in the morning. Now, it is very funny to go from Stendhal to Kara Ruda.
Yes, well.
Oh well, you know, I was a Stendhal. It was so funny. One of the first books when I could break into the adult section of the library when I was a kid, and I was about 9 years old, I was ready to read the adult books. And I read The Red and the Black, which is by Stendhal. And so it was one of my first adult books. And for some crazy reason, one morning, I mean, I read that years ago, and it's not like I don't have a million books in the house to read. You know, I get 12 books a week. And but I wanted to read that book. So there I am reading Stendhal. And then after a while, I'm sort of walking around the house. I had to get something to drink. And then I saw the book. I saw your book. And I said, okay, The Next Wife. I think that's my next book. Oh, my goodness. I mean, what can I say? It's such a delicious treat. One has to be forgiven. You know, because There's a book for every time in your life and every moment in your life, and something that's just perfect. And that book just hit me. I started reading it. I got such a kick out of it. And I kept thinking to myself, oh, there's Kara Ruda. She is so funny. I just love her. And as part of me was saying, you know, some people might say, well, you know, this is not, you know, Stendhal. And I would say, well, who cares? She's going to be a bestseller.
Not trying to be.
Excuse me. She's already a bestseller author, and she's going to sell a heck of a lot of these books, more than Stendhal ever sold. So I thought, you know, what the heck? Yeah, that's what the joy of paper is about, right? Finding and writing something that's fun, and you certainly did it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, that is the key to the type of book I write. I love to use dark humor, and you obviously got that part. I do like it, and I want to be entertaining. I'm not trying to be, highbrow literary here, but I'm glad you had fun with it.
Well, you know, they have a disease, you know. Do you know there's a syndrome called the Stendhal syndrome?
No.
Yes, there is. You have to look it up. As an author, this is an important, and it's a real disease. I mean, it's one of these diseases that doctors, you know, can write. And I have a feeling we're going to have the Ruda syndrome.
Good.
Yeah. I mean, really, where people are addicted to reading about women. Now, let's say you have a nice take on women. I'm sorry. And life doesn't really change that much. You know, I know we're supposed to, all women are supposed to be united. And if that was true, there would not be any affairs in this world. Nobody would have an affair with a married person if that was true. So let's just point. I don't know where to start with this book. We don't want to give it away because I'll tell you one thing really, I mean, great about your writing. You do the reveal. And this is what I always love in a book, where you reveal a little bit, a little bit, a little bit. You suck us into this book. You can't put it down. You forget about doing anything, housework and all that nasty stuff. You forget about cooking. You know you're going to have to order pizza because you're not going to cook. So people are going to develop the Ruda syndrome. That means a book you grab, you're going to sit down, and you're just going to keep reading it.
I love that. I mean, that is the best compliment, right? To me, that is. Some people are calling it a 5 popcorn box book. And, you know, it's just fun. So, yeah, you can't say much about The Next Wife without giving it away.
Don't give it away. I'm telling you, people, pick up the book, start reading, and about three paragraphs in, you're saying, is this Kara Ruda for real? Is she really writing this stuff? Is that how women are? And then you go on a little bit more. You say, yeah, I've known women like that. Oh, yes. And you keep, then you forget everything. And you're just in the book. It's like a movie in your head. It's a movie you might have seen, but you're enjoying every minute of it. Yes, with popcorn or a bag of chips. That helps.
Whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes. And if you're by the pool, with a daiquiri, you know. I mean, this is just a fun book. And I tell you right now, with all of the books out there and with all, you know, all the stress we're under, to have a book like this that takes you away and you really, literally forget about everything. And you get to the end and you're sort of analyzing a little, are there really people like that? Do I know people like that? Yeah, you know people like that. Your sister-in-law's like that, you know? So you're just like, it's delicious. It's delicious. It's nutritious for the mind. That's what I say.
Aww. Well, I like that. Thank you. I'll take it.
Oh, wow. I mean, and I also thought, well, she's having so much fun writing this book. I mean.
You're right. It is. It's super fun. And as much as it's good distraction for this heavy time, I was writing it during this heavy time. So it was a good distraction for me as well.
Well, it is. I just, you know, there. Yes, when you look back and you say, well, you're watching the repeats of Dallas and you're worrying about Sue Ellen. But there are people like this. Well, we hope that we aren't, but there are a lot of first wives and there are a lot of second wives out there who will get this book, third wives too, throw them all in. And then all those women who are not yet married and haven't had that joy.
that particular joy.
Yes. Yeah, that particular joy.
There are a lot of girls who are... daughters of divorce too. So.
Yes. I mean, you've got an audience. I mean, yes. I mean, best-selling author. Yes, I can see it. I know why. You deserve it. I'm sorry, Stendhal. I know. You worked so hard. The poor guy worked
poor
so
guy.
Hard on the Rouge et Lenoir. And we tried so hard. But he's not a best-selling book. I'm sorry about that. And Kara Ruda is, because we're not going to... And I have a feeling people will go back and read your other books, too.
Yeah, I hope so, because I've been writing... The last two were kind of in the same vein, Best Day Ever and The Favorite Daughter. So if they do like The Next Wife, they can go back.
Oh, they can go back, definitely. Isn't it nice that books are sold online so people can go back? People can go back. And, you know, it's in the old days, people would have to go... digging around bookstores, old secondhand bookstores, but now we have it all online. So all of her books are available, which is fantastic, because once you read this one, you will want to read the other ones, because yours a little bit kooky.
Yep.
A little bit strange. But it's just fun. I mean, and that's, you know, there's a place for everything, and there's a place for these kind of books, because we do need escape. When we're talking escape, we're escaping into lives that aren't, we hope, like ours.
Right.
Too much. Although then after that, you sort of do look at, if your husband has a personal assistant, you start wondering a few things, and you might, you know, there's a lot of, you know, what I like about the book, there's a lot of food for thought.
Really? Good.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you give us all these little chocolates and we're nibbling on them, and then we come across a little, you know, chocolate with a little bit of a zing in it, and we think, oh, she put some red pepper in that one. We want to know what life will bring us. And boy, you do it in these books. How'd you start? Tell us about the first one. I mean, you know, so many of my listeners, you know, during the pandemic-y times, I was telling people, start writing, become a writer. I mean, what else do you have to do? You know,
right, exactly.
And so many are. And I'm so proud that I get all these emails from people saying, oh, I wrote a book. I wrote a book. And I say, goody, goody, goody. And they're saying, I'm ready to query it. I said, but you just finished it. You know, like,
yeah.
I think there's a little bit more that goes into it. So how did you become a published author?
Yeah, so of course, like everybody who wants to write a book, it took a long time, because from the dream in third grade, I remember that's when I first knew I wanted to be a writer and a novelist, to, 10 years ago when I got my first book published. And I'm actually having an interview later today with my first agent, and we didn't sell anything. So she's like, I'd like to go over why we didn't work and why you had success with your next agent. I'm like, okay. I'll talk to you about that for a podcast. But anyway, it isn't a linear path, I've found, for most people. But the good news is today there's so many different publishing options, from self-published to hybrid to the traditional route, that if you really want to publish a book, you really can.
Absolutely. And what the thing is, that's nice. I think that's really cool that you're meeting with your first agent who shed some tears, let's just say, a bathtub full of tears, if I was her. If it's a girl,
it is a woman, yeah.
If I was her, I would sit in the bathtub and just cry and cry and cry.
Well, because, you know, we believed in each other, we just didn't have the right book at the right time.
That,
I think it is a lot about timing, too.
It is. Sometimes it is just that timing. And it's now timed perfectly. And this book, I think, you know, a lot of books come out during the pandemic-y time, and that are like a little bit too serious, a little bit too depressing. I mean, I've reviewed some of them, and I love them, and they're great books, but it's not really, you know, I'm worried that people won't get into them right now because they have all these problems around them. With your book, it is no problem to get into. I mean, really, it isn't. And so now your new and current agent, I'm sure, is a very, very happy person.
Yes, she is a very happy person and lucky to be with her. And like I said, there's a time, and for a while I was writing women's fiction, and then all of a sudden Paul, this kind of devious character in The Best Day Ever, popped into my head. So I wrote his story and sent it to her, and she's like, oh, I don't represent these kind of books. But please, will you read it? She's like, no. So I had to have my beta readers read it. They loved it. So I sent it back to my agent. I'm like, okay, please just give it a try for me. And she read it in one night, and of course, then she sold it. So
yeah,
there you have it.
Yeah, that's I could see why, because these books, as I said, are rather delicious. Not only is it wonderful as a book, because of course I love to read, and I like to put it on my Kindle because then I can mark up and save passages that I want to go back to. But the Audible version of this book is also great. And I love Audible versions of these kind of books because it doesn't take, you know, you're concentrating on the book, and but you see it in your head as a movie. And it's, mm-hmm. I think it's absolutely delightful.
It is. It's so great. The talent of the actors who read these books and bring them to life. It's just, I'm so impressed because I could never do it. But in this case with The Next Wife, there are four different actors who are telling you the story from different perspectives of the characters.
Because you've told it in alternative
points of view.
Points of view. And so you alternate, and we go back and forth, and then we learn about all the four main characters. And I love books with four voices. I don't know that somehow I really enjoy listening to that. It's really like a movie in your head. You know, that's why radio in the old days was so successful, because people could listen and visualize what was going on. And with your books, the actors must also have a heck of a fun time.
I hope they do. I've never met them, but they sound great. So I'm going to assume they're having fun.
Well, I do. I think they do, because it's not as much fun. I'm going to tell you right now. I don't want to say something about Stendhal again, but yes, I mean, it's not as much fun listening to Stendhal as your books. And it's just, again, you know, just having that ability. It's a talent. It's not that this book is easy, because you have had to create the tension. There's a lot of arcs that you've had to meet, and a lot of reveals that you've had to create. So it's actually a very complex book.
Yeah, I mean, it is, but hopefully all of that's hidden.
Oh, it's hidden. It's hidden, because all you do is you're reading this and you say, oh, these ladies are ladies. but really, in the end, a book that relates to human beings, that brings human beings, our emotions, our personalities, and really, you know, highlights aspects of them, even if the aspects aren't always the nicest aspects, it's still fun to read about them.
Thank you. I mean, I do have fun with my characters, because both Kate and Tish, the first wife and the next wife, are very strong women, and they know what they want, and they are on a mission to get it.
Yeah.
So, and we have two great antagonists in the book. It makes it really fun.
It does. And as I said, people will, if they don't want to admit themselves that they are like any of the characters, although there's strong women, and strong women can read this and say, okay, well, I'm a strong woman, but, you know, these things happen to me too. You know, I don't care what you, life throws stuff at you, and some of it sticks, and sometimes it's funny stuff like this that happens, and I think it's just, I found it so delightful to read. Now, where do people follow you? The book is available wherever books are sold. I hope bookstores are open.
Yep.
I don't know if bookstores are open. Libraries, I would hope they're carrying it.
I had a virtual event with my local bookstore, but I'm hoping, I mean, but they're open for business now too. So it's just slowly coming back. They can't have events yet, but they are open. Bookstores are open, which is great. And yes, available online and at your favorite local bookstore too, and libraries.
And of course, what's your webpage?
Oh, you can find me. So I have a tough name with a lot of vowels, as you noticed. So it's Kara, kairouda.com, which is KAIRARODA.com.
What kind of name is that? Is that?
It's mine.
No, I know it's yours. I mean, did you just make it up, or is it as a nationality?
No, well, my mom found Kara when she was living in Oregon from an indigenous name, I guess, but I don't know what. She was just reading the magazine and found the name, so she really liked it. And my husband, his last name is Ruda. My maiden name was Sturdivant, so that wouldn't roll off your
tongue. No, I like Ruda. It's yeah. Appropriate for you, because your books are just a little bit rude, and I think it's perfect. Now, tell me something. So you wanted to write from the time you were in third grade. Did you have a nice third grade teacher?
I had a great third grade teacher, and I can remember my librarian, Mrs. Gardier. I can remember, like, at the building in the room, but I cannot remember my third grade teacher's name. But aside from that, she had us write to the person we wanted to be when we grew up. So I wrote to Robert McCloskey, who wrote Make Way for Ducklings and Blueberries for Sal. And I wrote to him, and I said, I want to be just like you when I grow up and be an author. And he wrote back and said, well, I'm an illustrator, not an author. You should pick better next time, but good luck to you.
that's perfect.
Journey in a nutshell.
You have to find that third grade teacher, because that was a...
I do.
You really do. She deserves a copy of this book, signed and autographed by you.
I know. I found my librarian, Mrs. Gardier, and yes, I need to go on.
Well, unless you destroyed your report cards, her name is there somewhere.
I know.
I did destroy a report card once because the only D I ever got in my life, the only D. Mm. Fifth grade, the teacher gave me a D because I wouldn't. In baseball, well, you're supposed to throw underhanded, but I threw like a boy. And so she gave me a D. It's the only D I ever received in school. And I destroyed that report card. I was so angry when I saw that D. And then I had to, of course, explain to my parents why I did that. But my mother, who was in a baseball team during World War II, and she's the one who taught me how to throw like a guy, and I learned to throw that way, and so she didn't get too mad at me. But
I
want you to find that third grade teacher. As a matter of fact, if you find that third grade teacher, I want you to come back on the program with her. I want to hear what kind of a little girl you were in third grade that you would write to this illustrator. You find her, okay? This is a task. Now, now you're rich and famous and best-selling author. You can afford a private investigator.
Uh-huh.
You get out there or put it on social media and find this lady. She deserves to come on the program because she obviously encouraged you to do something nice.
She did. And really, I like credit her with making me believe it was possible.
Okay. Well, where is she? The minute you find her,
I need to find her. You're right. Well, she's in Lincoln, Massachusetts. That's where I was in elementary school.
Hire a private eye.
Andy Pond Lane.
Okay, and you have her on the program. Contact me. I want you back on the program because we'll talk about the other books too, because I think they're delicious. Okay.
All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Okay. Kara, Ruda, fantastic. And I'm sure you're on Facebook too, right? And all of that stuff.
Oh, I am. Yeah. Facebook, Instagram, all the social medias. Yep.
Okay. And it's KAIRA. And it's Ruda, RODA. And available wherever books are sold. The Next Wife. And I'm looking forward to the next book. Thank you so much for joining me today, Kara. Wonderful talking to you.
Thank you for having me. You too. I'm off to find my teacher.
Okay. Off you go. Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Fantastic. Oh, she's so cute. Oh, I know people. Oh, come on. Get over it. You know, there are people who will say, well, you know, some of these women in her book aren't very nice. Well, get real. I mean, I have known women like every character she writes about, to tell you the truth. Not that I have ever been anything like that, because I didn't have those same experiences, but I could have been, because I must have, I don't know, it tickled me pink. That's all I can say. It just tickled me pink. And it's a delicious, you know, one of these books that you read and you say, okay, well, maybe it's not, you know, great literature. Well, I don't know. I think it's pretty great. If you can write a bestseller, you're a pretty great author. That's what I think. You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And in a way, the nice thing is, just like Stendhal wrote about his time, this book is in many ways a book of our times, and just an enjoyable read. I think there's been some criticism about, you know, stereotypical, but aren't we all stereotypical in one way or another? So just enjoy the book. Sometimes you just have to pick up a book, read it, and say, what the heck? I'm going to have a fun time today. I'm going to read this book and either have, I don't know, so you might want a bag of potato chips, popcorn, or a tub of ice cream. But whatever you get, sit there and read it, enjoy it, and for a little while, forget about these pandemic-y times. Forget about all the news and everything else, just for a little while. I know we have to pay attention to what's going on in the world, but there are times that you just need that break. You need that relief. And so for all of you out there, you know, when you're writing books, you have to sometimes think of your audience. And as I said, I did get a lot of books recently that are, and I hope, and I'm, oh, please, I'm not going to review 100 million books about the pandemic. I can't do it. My nerves can't take it. And I'm not going to do any books about leprosy. And if anybody sends me another book about leprosy, I am going to go crazy. Forget it. This is not a trend. I don't want to hear this. And people, you know, and also I don't want any more books with the word girl in the title or the book or the red in the title. Those are the two I'm getting. Well, the girl ones are done. Now I'm getting books. Every book has a title. It has red in it. Enough already. Anyway, everybody, it's been a great day. Remember, one of the things I always tell you, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or if you're lucky, a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I'm hoping for Carol J. Perry, who writes Witch City Mysteries, and she is going to be on the program this month with her newest book. Oh, wow, this is so exciting. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. And he's saluting me. I'm saluting him. Everybody have a wonderful, wonderful day. And get both of these books. You know, it's just so much fun to read and to learn the story behind the book. Bye-bye now.